Hi, and welcome to Wine, Women, and Revolution. I'm your host, Heather Warburton, coming at you here on New Jersey Revolution Radio. You can find us online at www.njrevolutionradio.com. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and get us wherever you get your podcasts from. Today, we're trying a new kind of format of an episode. I get some of my friends together, and we kind of casually hang out and talk about what's going on in the world, sort of my version of Brian's What the Fuck, only, I don't know what we're going to call it, but it's a new format for us tonight, and I want to welcome my friend Mason back to the show.
Hello, thank you.
You've been on the show at least once before, yes. Possibly a couple of times, and that is the very first thing I wanted to get to, is you are with the group For the People.
That's right.
I'm just going to link so people can see what you have done up until then, a little more explanation of who For the People are. But what have you been up to as an organization? It's been a while since you've been here. What have you guys been up to?
So much has happened. I think the last time I was here was like in the summer. So at that time, we had only done maybe like two or three food distribution events in the city. And it's been nonstop ever since then. So we conduct weekly food distributions. And we also have, we try to have at least like once a month, we have like food and clothing, stuff like that. Actually, on January 28th, from 12 to 2 p.m. in Stanley Homes Villages in Atlantic City, we're doing a clothing distribution, and we're going to try and bring more people into the newly formed organizing committee. So,
all right, let's talk about that. The support committee, right, is what you're talking about, or...
Oh, no, that was the organizing committee.
Oh, the organizing committee.
Yeah, okay. I know, too many committees.
Lots of committees. It's a problem on the left here.
But actually, yeah, like the support committee is a separate thing. It's just basically what we're trying to do is formalize and get the get it more organized, like the network of support that we've sort of built over the past 8 months. So what it is, the support committee is just a coalition of groups and individuals that want to support our work, support the idea, at least, of people being in control of their own communities. And so getting together organizations, businesses, and individuals who might be sympathetic to those goals is what we're trying to do, and put them into one committee where they can talk about what kind of help they want to provide, whether that's actual material support, resources, donations, things like that, or if they want to boost us in any way, or if they want to actually have volunteers that come from them to us and actually participate in the organizing and running of the events that we have.
So there's lots of options. No matter how many people want to get involved, there's probably some way for them to do it. It's very cool that you guys are doing food distribution so much more often now. Like, I think you're only once a month you had the resources for when you were here before.
Yeah. So like at the time, what we were doing is we you know, there still is, and this is the group that is responsible for collecting the food donations. AC Food Not Bombs was the main organizer of the event. Now I would consider them like a partner and like a co-organizer of the event. So like they actually get the food from Acme and they give it to us, and we distribute it at our For the People events. And that's where we get all kinds of fresh produce. Or not, it's good produce. Like it's good produce, but it's stuff that they're gonna like throw out.
So, right, because there's some weird regulations with grocery stores, and they throw out anything that's not beautiful and perfect.
Right, and like all the things, consumable. Like, yeah, like they're all good food. It's all good. It's like you could easily have it for like another, you know, a little while longer at least. So,
right.
And for, you know, just to get people by for a couple of days, it's, you know, it's super not a problem. And so, yeah, like produce, dairy products, bread, even like desserts and stuff like that, we get and food donations. So it's really helpful for people that maybe can't go afford to go grocery shopping and they still need to feed their family. So it's like, you know, a couple of days worth of food. And
right.
Yeah. And that's and it's thanks to AC Food Not Bombs that does that, and, you know, gets that food for us. And and of course we're the ones that distribute it, and we have our political sort of education that we try to have with our engagements with the people in the community.
How many people from the community have gotten really involved after engaging?
Yeah, you know, so we have, there's pretty much like a few different people every week who are actually from the community that we're trying to serve. and they participate in actually running the events. So we try to have as much hands-off on the actual running of the event itself as possible. We just like to sort of try to talk to people, try to get their contact information, try to talk to them about the problems that they're facing, and also assist in actually handing out the food. So you know, we're more likely to listen to the directives or the order of like one of the people from the community than like the other way around.
Right. And now when we're recording this, I don't know exactly when it'll go up, but now when we're recording it, we're still in the middle of the government shutdown. I don't know how many days we're going on so far. Do you have any idea how many days it is so far?
I want to say it's like 33, I think, Ron.
Right. Maybe it's been 34. Like a month that we've had people without paychecks. And
yeah, and that's...
And now services are falling away, too. So things are getting worse and worse here in Atlantic County. I assume that may be drawing more and more people to your events.
Definitely. And also, like, it's not just the government workers that are being affected because, you know, we don't really have, like, a whole lot of government workers in the areas that we work in Atlantic City. It's mostly low-income people, and it's people that rely on food stamps and Section 8 housing, which is a benefit that is going to be cut and slashed, and it's not going to be available for people in Atlantic City. And, you know, in maybe the next month or 2 months, that, you know, all of those things are going to be dried up, and there's going to be a lot of hungry people, and the food banks do not have enough resources to feed them all.
Right, and people, and this is kind of part of what your goal is that I think is important to talk about, is building alternative structures to get those needs met. That, you know, if you only rely on this one channel of resources and it's not coming from the people, then when those systems fail, which inevitably we're seeing now they do, that we reach these crisis states, that if you don't have these alternative structures, people are in trouble, like even in more dire trouble than they would be.
Yes, we have a name actually for those structures, and we call it organs of political power. And basically that means that, like, it's building towards the idea that people who live in a community get to decide what resources go into it, like how those resources are distributed, what services are available, like what economic development occurs, and you know, what jobs are available, and what kind of authority any given business or state authority has, like, in their communities to begin with. So it's essentially taking power from one institution and transferring it to another one, and that new institution is the organs of political power for the people, and that's people who are in the communities themselves that are going to be able to call all the shots.
And I assume you would be comfortable saying that you're an anti-capitalist being on this show.
I am a communist. I know it's a bad word to say.
It's definitely not a bad word, you know, here.
It's not a bad word here, but, you know, in some parts, you know, you tell people that you're a communist, and like, this actually happened to me at a bar once. But
is this your favorite line at a bar? You know, I'm a communist.
Literally. I remember I was in a bar and I was talking to some friends about communist related ideas, and this guy was kind of listening. He was next to us, and he was like, you know, like, what are you guys talking about? You know, what are you? And I was like, oh, well, I'm a communist. And he was like, wow, you really believe in all that? And like, he was just like making fun of me. And, but then we had like a 30, like 40 minute conversation at the end of it. He was like, wow, you know, at first I kind of just thought you were a joke, but like, I actually respect you and I understand your position. Like, thanks for talking to me. And I'm like, yeah, no problem. So it's like, you know, you have...
Yeah, I do that. I like to go to coffee shops and, like, talk about socialism in coffee shops. And, you know, you hear people start, like, listening and, like, laughing at you. But by the end, they're like, oh, you know, maybe you do change some minds when you're very open about being anti-capitalist or socialist or communist or what have you.
Yeah, because, you know, we believe that, like, you know, there's a... it's funny, but we use the term like science, or like science of revolution. And that's like that we understand that there are certain processes, there's certain things that happen, and being able to like sort of take control of those conditions and transform them, and like the study of that is sort of the philosophical contribution of communism. And that's why it's important to say that if you're a communist, you should say that you're a communist, and you should be very open about what that means and like what you want, because in order to get to the position where you can start changing the society, like, you know, people got to know what, at least like what the goalposts are. Like they got to have like a general right. idea of like where you're going. Like that's always like, that's such a huge question that we get. Like, when we talk to people in Atlantic City, is like, people are like, you know, are you with a church? We're like, no, we're not with a church. We're, you know, we're a political organization. And people have this idea of political or what politics means. And generally it's relegated to, the electoral system, but very specifically often the battle, quote unquote, between Republicans and Democrats.
Right. Between two capitalist yeah. parties, the margins between the two are thin and often non-existent.
Non-existent. and yeah, we'll talk about this shortly, but Venezuela is like a really good example. This is a bipartisan effort to invade and topple the government of Venezuela. So,
well, did you know I actually just declared myself president of the United States right now?
There you go.
And you're lucky to be here on this auspicious occasion, because I'm going to be swearing myself blessed. In any moment now for my, I so accept blessed. This, you know, position of president that no one specifically wanted me to anyway right. have, but I do accept that now, and I'm really honored, and I just need all the foreign governments to support me.
They better. Because if not, the U.S. will invade.
Right, right. Bring me democracy.
Yeah, yes.
So, but what I'm joking about, I'm making light of a fairly serious situation of
absolutely.
What's going on in Venezuela. Of we're intervening yet again as an imperialist nation. That's what we do. And bringing capitalism to people that, I don't know, don't have enough capitalism yet. I don't even know what the what the excuse is.
Oh, we can. Oh, yeah, we can talk about that. We can talk about that. Let's dive right in there. Let's have an analysis of what is actually going on in Venezuela right. on the ground for like the past couple of years. But keep in mind, this is something that's been going on since 2002. Like the United States backed a coup in 2002 against the government of Hugo Chavez, and it failed. And they tried multiple times after that point, and in very recently, we had, I think maybe last year, you had a situation where there were people burning down, burning down the streets in Venezuela. And there was like this very, very inaccurate, like misconception of what was going on. And people were like, oh, it's a popular uprising against, you know, the tyranny of Nicolas Maduro. And that really was very, very false, because really what it was a dying capitalist class struggling to preserve itself in Venezuela as the Bolivarian Revolution intensifies in Venezuela. And the capitalist class in Venezuela is losing their power. And so that's what happens. Like, they fight back. And, you know, they don't have control of the government. So the next best thing is to get, you know, is to rally all of the middle class and like the small business owners and the small producers in Venezuela and especially the youth of those classes, and get them mobilized and burning down grocery stores and hospitals, and calling it a revolution, but really it was just a counter revolution, and it was 100% backed, financed, probably armed by the United States. And there were this thing had very deep roots in the country, like in every institution, like the military, there were people in
and
the
we
military.
We have a history of doing this.
Yeah.
It shouldn't be that surprising to most people,
right.
I would hope that, mm-hmm. you know, the U.S. has invaded and had coups and tried to assassinate foreign leaders. Like, we have a long history of doing this.
Yeah.
And so this shouldn't come as a surprise that it's a U.S.-backed intervention into...
It is. It is. And specifically because what just happened, I might not be able to pronounce his name correctly, but I think it's Guaido or Guaido. And he's the opposition leader of another party that's representing like the capitalist interests in Venezuela, and he declared himself like president of Venezuela, despite the National Assembly in Venezuela being pretty much like suspended by the Supreme Court for the actions that it took in the previous year during the insurrections, and this, so this guy declared himself president, and the United States, Trump, and the vice president both said, you know, the legitimate government of Venezuela is this opposition leader, and that's the only legitimate government that we recognize, and basically very explicitly saying that Maduro's government was illegitimate and that the United States would support regime change. And that can only mean that they're laying the groundwork for invasion, because now if their guy starts losing, and again, like, there's probably already special forces troops and CIA, like, in Venezuela right now, like, doing this training. But once this opposition starts to lose, the United States is going to use that as a pretext to invade Venezuela. And its justification will be that the legitimate government of Venezuela asked them for help. So this is something that we've seen in Latin America so many times. In fact, it's, you know, Latin America has to be one of the United States' greatest sources of stolen wealth on a continuous, like, day-to-day basis. And, like, the system of imperialism is totally predicated and sustained by that, so.
Absolutely. And, you know, I was just editing an interview today that will go up next week for when I'm recording this, talking about how, you know, we're a land of stolen people and stolen wealth, you know, and that's what is required for capitalism. And I guess maybe that is a good transition into talking about some of the problems of capitalism and contradictions of it, and how, you know, you were talking a little bit about the scientific approach that, like, Marx would take to explaining capitalism and the crisis of capitalism that come up. And you've read a lot more Marx than I have, I will readily admit it on this discussion. I've read some of the bases, but let's get into a little bit about how capitalism, you know, a scientific study of capitalism would ultimately lead you into seeing that capitalism's going to fail. And, you know, the one thing that I was just talking about was we've run out of resources to exploit. In this country, you have to keep finding new and new resources to exploit. And eventually those are going to run out, I think, is one of the first major critiques you can have of capitalism. There are others, like, for example, earlier today you had sent me a reading list about how eventually there's a diminished...
it's called, like, surplus value, but yeah. It can just be... You can just say it's profit. It's the same right. thing. Right. Yeah.
And you wanted to specifically talk about that a little bit tonight.
Yeah. So
why is that important? Diminishment of profit in capitalism.
Yeah, so Marx calls this the theory of the tendency of the rate of profit to fall.
That's and a lot of words.
It's in typical 1800s fashion.
Right.
If you were in Germany, then you were giving all of your doctrines, like, really long names. But it's a concept that I'm still learning more about. And I have to say this because the more I understand Marxism and the more I learn about Marxism and the more Marx I read, the more I realize that, like, there's so much that I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's always the case.
Yeah. And, like, I'd heard this word before, the tendency of the rate of profit to fall. And I kind of just had, like, in my head, maybe the idea that, like profits aren't sustainable. But there's like so much more to that question. And so basically what's going on right now currently is we're entering another crisis of capitalism. And the great, like, current crisis era of capitalism really started in 2007 with the United States. And that was the collapse of multiple industries that had to be bailed out hundreds of billions of dollars. You could say trillions, actually.
By the time you add everything up, yeah, probably. Yeah.
Right. Of subsidized, of bailing out the banks, like bailing out the automakers.
It was a massive transfer of wealth.
It was.
To the banks and Wall Street.
And the thing is that, like, that was a crisis, right? Like, that was, like, what you would really call, like, a crisis of capitalism. And so, you know, there was a slight, like, economic recovery in terms of profits being made and all these things. But you know, those benefits were never really, like, reflected onto the working people.
Right.
And in fact, like, people's economic situation now, I would argue, is worse than it was in 2007 for most people. And so what we have this crisis of capitalism, and it supposedly got better, but really it didn't really get better. There was just some temporary relief measures that were taken, like people starting getting jobs again. You know, the unemployment rate that they give us is not, you know, 10 or 11% anymore. So, like, there are certain, like, you know, data that you could say, oh, the economy is doing better, but...
Right, what does that really mean for the average person? And very little. Does it mean most new wealth created since that has gone to a very select handful of people?
Yeah.
So most that wealth has been extracted, again, from somewhere. That right. wealth didn't just magically get created. It's being taken from somewhere, either where the wealth of Latin America or the wealth of the workers in this country.
Yeah. And that's actually, like, you'll see, like, if you look at 2007 and 2008, you can see how actually when we were supposed to be drawing down from Iraq and Afghanistan, we were just, well, I shouldn't say we, because I should just say the United States government. The U.S. government sent its troops into more countries than we've probably ever occupied in American history. And the amount of presence that we have illegally or even legally, but just occupying and invading, like, new countries and new territory is just really unprecedented on a world historical scale.
And that's required for capitalism to constantly be finding new places to draw wealth from. Yes. That's how we're keeping the system going. We're propping it up, as it were.
And that's actually
and
how...
And hiding some of the crisis of capitalism.
Right. And that's a thing, like, is that actually, like, this... The whole system and idea of capitalism, like, actually comes from a development of colonialism. Like, it originally, like, colonialism, 14, 1500s, 1600s, was really just designed to extract wealth and resources for the monarchy. And what you have after the period of colonialism and into the development of capitalism, you have a merchant class and, like, a very small producer class that are struggling against the system of feudalism to recognize, like, their own control over private property. And so in order to really have any kind of power to fight the monarchy, like, they got to have actual resources and land and labor to be, like, on their side. And so in order to really make huge purchases of capital, you need to have a labor source that can be so extremely exploited that really you don't really stand a chance of losing money. And being able to produce, like, so much for so little in specific is going to create, like, all this profit or the surplus value. And that's going to serve as what Marx calls the primitive accumulation of capital. And essentially that was because of slavery and because of colonialism from Europe and because of the massive theft of land and genocide of Native Americans on this continent. So this new capitalist class ends up having all of this new land, all of this new purchasing power, like, all this new capital through slavery and through colonialism, that it's actually able to own even greater means of production. And that's when factories and industry actually starts to become developed, is because this new capitalist class was able to get so much wealth from slavery and colonialism that it was able to actually rupture from feudalism. It was able to break away from monarchy and say, like, no, this new class is the one that has control over the property and over private property. And then we get into the development of capitalism. So it goes from merchant capital to industrial capital. And then finally, where it is today is what we call finance capital. And that's when banks and industry essentially had to merge, because in order to grow even beyond what industry had already achieved at that point,
and again, keep this unsustainable system going.
Right. Because it was falling. basically they need loans, they need credit. They got to, you know, there has to be some kind of value that's attached to the currency that is based in some kind of commodity or some kind of raw material or resource or whatever it is that can actually serve as like a way for capital itself to grow. And so like you have the emergence of finance monopoly capital, as Lenin calls it. And this is the basis of imperialism. And the reason why it has to do this, first and foremost, is because all the profits are being dried up, as you said earlier, in the homeland, in the U.S. Like, you started to have, like, this labor movement, and people... You had, like, these crises of overproduction where the system itself was unable to continue itself because it had fallen to this inevitable trap of overproduction. And so you'd have industries that would collapse and go. So in order to kind of stop this from happening like that, they needed like to concentrate that capital and make it stronger and have it produce more and sell more and therefore have like more profit. And so that is the way that imperialism was formed, as a way to combat the tendency of the rate of profit to fall, because of these crises of overproduction. And because of this, these competitions that industry has with each other in order to make more money, it has to find new ways of producing faster for less. And so that's why you have like the development of factories at such a phenomenal rate in the 20th century, is because of this competition. And you have to have, because of this competition, basically it creates like even greater means of production, like even greater ability to produce more for less. And eventually you're at a point where you're producing things that nobody's buying, whether that's because they don't have money, because they aren't paid enough, or because like they have no use for it. And so that's why you have like the collapse of industries. And so finance capital basically keeps this alive, keeps the system alive, by exporting capital and basically creating entire nations. Like, so many of the nations in Latin America and Africa and like Southeast Asia, like, they didn't used to exist a couple hundred years ago. Like, they were made by like this new imperialist system where basically these competing imperialist powers had to divide up the world so that they could, that their finance capital could be exported to those colonies and to that new division of the world, and actually like restructure the economy to produce only like one or two different commodities that can actually be exported. So you have like a reinvention of feudalism, almost, where like,
right, yeah, and like, to tie it back to, you know, the earlier conversation where we started off talking tonight, was now they have no abilities to sustain themselves because they're only producing one or two major commodities. They're not producing, you know, and in control of their own way. They're going to have to import everything themselves now. They have none of these alternative power structures, because they're only making, you know, bananas, for example. Yes. Is some a historically yes. economy that this was done with, yeah. was, you know, the Banana Republic. Yes. And so that ties well that back around into what we were talking about earlier of how you need to have these power structures locally and the ability to provide for yourself locally.
Yeah.
In the hands of the people.
In the hands of the people. And we also recognize like that with regard to nations, which again are not, these nations did not come about on their own. Like, these countries that exist, like, it wasn't like a natural process that they actually came into existence in the first place. And all of the capitalism that develops in these countries are not actually controlled by those countries. They're controlled by imperialism. And they're controlled specifically through like the dominance of finance monopoly capital, like organizations like the World Bank or the IMF give out loans to these countries for hundreds of millions of dollars. And those countries are basically forced to take those loans because the leaders of those countries are people that are often handpicked by the countries of imperialism.
Right. That's what they're there to do, is to take the loans and keep the finance capital moving.
Yes. Yes. And so
that's their job.
Yeah. And so, yeah, you have all of this new capital and you have all of these new factories and means of production, you have infrastructure and all of this stuff. But none of that is actually accessible to or owned by the people of that country. And the people have no other choice but to work in those new factories and in those new mines or fields or whatever the case may be, because they don't have even control over their land. Like, even the land itself is considered like assets by banks. And so the people don't have a choice. They get pushed out of an area and they're homeless, they're poor, like they don't have anything. And all of a sudden you have like these new factories that pay 23 cents an hour or something ridiculous like that, even less maybe. And that's the only option for them to actually survive, is to take these horrible, horrendous jobs. And because they take these jobs, there's so much profit because so little is expended on labor and working conditions. The only real expense that's made is like in the actual equipment itself. And it's there's no sense of like obligation towards safekeeping of human life. Like, it's, these conditions are essentially slavery, just under a different name. And it's literally what the entire U.S. economy is based on, and every other imperialist like country, whether that's in Europe or elsewhere. And if you just look, like, Venezuela has the largest oil reserves in the entire world, and Venezuela is also one of the only oil rich countries that is not trading in the way that the U.S. wants them to trade. And so for a couple of years, there's been like this economic war against Venezuela, which include all kinds of things like trade sanctions and just price control on the market to devalue like the price of oil, for instance. So like Venezuela's oil fields are nationalized, and for the most part, and so that profit goes into the country as like direct income. And the problem is that because the price of oil dropped, they're not able to really export something that brings them a lot of value. And especially because now there's oil sanctions against Venezuela. Venezuela doesn't have a whole lot of options to actually sustain itself in revenue. And this was like one measure to get like Venezuela to sell its national assets to the United States, was basically just to force them into it by giving them no other option. And so that didn't work. And so Maduro, the government in Venezuela started putting like these limits on how much food could actually cost in a supermarket, and they made the food in the supermarkets to be really cheap, and so that poor people could afford to eat. And what ended up happening was that these supermarkets were not making the kind of profit that they were beforehand, and so what they ended up doing was actually hoarding this food, and in many cases like selling it over the border into Colombia, on the black market for like really, really inflated prices. And so what you have is this food crisis where like Venezuela can't really afford to buy a whole lot of food because it's not getting as much revenue. And then two, you have these owners of like supermarkets and like these food producers that are either hoarding or outright burning their food to force the value of the prices of their food to go up. And you can look online. I mean, this
really, is just some really, conspiracy yeah. theory that yeah. you're spewing off.
You can see pictures. You can see like whole like in the back during when all these people are hungry, like just these huge warehouse almost size like rooms that are just filled with food that is destroyed or just being kept and not given to the people because those supermarkets don't want to charge those low prices. And so that's why you have a food crisis. And so that's where that started, right? And then so you get this situation where the capitalist class in Venezuela is getting like, you know, some of these people riled up and against the government of Venezuela, blaming them for their problems. And you get the U.S. supporting them, and then you get now the U.S. is talking about recognizing an illegitimate government. And
right, which sounds a lot like an act of war, actually. Like,
yes.
I'm not sure if that count is one of the acts of war, but it sounds a lot like it should be an act of war, that we're declaring somebody else the leader of a government.
Right. And it is, especially for us, because the United States is the superpower in the Western Hemisphere. And Latin America has been subjugated to the United States for decades, over a century, if you want to talk about when they first fought Spain over control over those colonial territories. But like even before that, I mean, the most profitable and also the most brutal slave plantations were in Latin America. And so this is just a continuation of that policy. You know, the United States really wants control over those oil fields. There's all different kinds of resources because it's a it's that kind of climate where you have mines, minerals, like all that stuff besides just oil. Yeah.
So I'm going to take it off in a different direction here, just something I want to talk about now.
Okay.
We keep having these crises of capitalism.
Yeah.
Are you one of a believer that it's one of those crises of capitalism that's going to lead to the fall of capitalism? It's going to directly come out of one of those crises, that something's going to happen? Or do you think it's an accumulation of things? Like, we know capitalism's not going to be able to sustain itself forever. What do you think is ultimately going to lead to the fall?
It's going to take the actual conscious effort of the people. It's not going to happen. I want to like make sure that people understand that like we shouldn't fall into the trap of thinking that it's just going to collapse on its own. Even if the economy were to collapse, it's not going to guarantee an end to capitalism. In fact, it's probably not going to end capitalism at all. It's definitely not going to end imperialism. It's still going to continue. It may be weakened, but it's going to continue on its own. In order to actually transform, in order to rupture from and break capitalism, imperialism, and build socialism, is through a very deliberate effort to do so on a very wide scale, and that's why we need revolution in the first place. And basically, you can have a crisis of capitalism, but if the contradictions of that system, like the struggles that people face, and the identification of their class enemies isn't actually understood in a wide enough scale, then the people aren't going to be motivated by themselves to have a revolution. So that's why you need revolutionary organizations and people to go out to the people and get them organized and to sharpen these contradictions of capitalism to them and build, like, so that these, like, new organs of political power can be concentrated in base areas to expand from and grow and intensify the revolutionary movement.
So, and, you know, climate change is one of my big things that I always talk about. We have about 10 years to get off fossil fuels, or, you know, we lock in the worst of climate change. Do you think we'll get to the revolution in time to save ourselves?
No.
What's it gonna, don't think so? We're all just screwed.
I think we can. I think we should. But I don't know. It's not gonna, like I said, it's not gonna happen on its own. And it's gonna take a lot more effort than is currently being exerted to get people organized and mobilized. And that is basically like the principal task, is that, you know, if imperialism continues, if this society continues the way it is, it's going to be disastrous on an unprecedented level, and it's going to take a long time to recover from, if at all. And it's a very urgent question, and it's climate change is a huge part of it. It's something that could have been avoided. And it's something that can be slowed down.
Right,
it can't
be
stopped.
Right, this is not something that we just learned about.
Yeah.
It's actually like over 100 years we've known about climate change.
Yeah.
So, and we chose to favor capitalism instead of not killing ourselves.
And that ignoring of climate change, that's a direct result from capitalist imperialism. Like, the people who live in the global south can directly experience the effects of what industrial capitalism has done and continues to do to the earth and its people. Like, I mean, living conditions are horrible due to the kind of pollution that companies can get away with as they extract these resources and labor from the global south. And it's not something that Americans have... or most Americans have really had to consider.
Right, some of the more poor communities, for sure. Like,
yeah, exactly.
They store that waste in the most marginalized of communities.
Yeah, like, when I was born and raised in the city of Rochester, New York, and it was, like, it had, like, a really prosperous, like, Kodak factory. And in the 90s, it collapsed due to a lot of different problems, but all the factories in the area started closing down and outsourcing. And but before that, like, Kodak had actually dumped so many chemicals into Lake Ontario and, like, the river that goes into Rochester that you couldn't even swim in the water. It was so bad, and the entire city stank. And you'd have, like, washed up fish that were just dead, or, like, it was just such a bad time for people to live in Rochester because of what, like, capitalism was able to get away with. But the thing is that they weren't able to get away with that in America any longer, so they had to outsource, and so they had to export capital. And so it really is, like, you know, the fact that Americans have had the expectation of a middle-class lifestyle for so long, which itself was only possible because of imperialism, because these companies made so much money extracting, like, these super profits from the global south, like, they were able to pay the workers in America more, and so they were able to give more concessions to trade unions. And so the trade unions became about upholding and keeping those concessions instead of actually fomenting some kind of oppositional power to capitalism. And that's my big criticism of unions. So if you're in a union and you hear that, listen up, because this is important.
I've had this exact same conversation with some union friends of the show out in my kitchen. We've stood around and talked about it.
Yeah. So. Actually, there's a great book. It's called Settlers. It's by someone named Jay Sakai. And if you're in a union, you should read that book, because it really explains how the union movement has been about sort of keeping these crumbs from imperialism and being more about, like, the even distribution of the wealth stolen from the global south in America, as opposed to actually challenging imperialism. So I recommend that book. But also it's relevant to what we're talking about, because, like, this middle class lifestyle in America has predominated, like, the majority of Americans, like, minds, like, I've got to have a house, I got to have some land. Like, that's a concept that, like, is actually really unique to imperialism. And so, like, this whole country, like, is filled with, like, a large amount of people that believe that they are entitled to the lifestyle provided to them by imperialism. And it's that is like the ideological barrier to stopping climate change, because it actually would require people to give up a lot of things that they hold very dear. Like, I had a year ago when I was at Stockton, I had this class called Environmental Sustainability, and I learned that, like, the average, like, even if you don't live in the suburbs and you live in a city, like, it's actually ridiculous, but, like, for the average, like, suburban person, in order to sustain their lifestyle, if every single person on the planet lived like someone in a middle class, like, suburban lifestyle lives, then it would require 4.5 Earths.
I've heard that exact same statistic. Yeah, that's what it would require.
5.5 sometimes, even
to
more.
To sustain everyone at the American middle class suburban lifestyle.
It's insanity. It's like, so nobody wants to give that up. Like, that's an actual, like, material benefit that capitalist imperialism has actually bestowed upon the working class in America. And so that's, like, an actual, like, real obstacle to getting people into revolution, because people are like, I kind of like this. I don't want to give this up.
Right. Even though they, like, know it's going to lead to death eventually. Yes. We're going to go extinct as a population. But, you know, it's the immediate, I like my pool.
and all of that. So that's one
of the barriers
that's
to actually...
huge barrier.
An organizational barrier. What are the ends? We've talked a little bit about the environment as one of the ends, but what else have you found has been good ways, just as an organizer, I'm curious, what you found to engage people to start thinking about things differently and start organizing in their own areas?
For sure. It totally 100% depends on who I'm talking to and where I'm at. There's a lot of folks that are like my age that... are working, like,
they're
low
a baby.
Income.
Just if you don't know, Mason, they are a baby.
I'm not that young. I'm 28. But anyway, like, I know a lot of, like, I have a lot of friends, and I know a lot of people who are just, like, low-income workers $8, $9, $10, maybe $11 or $12 an hour if they're lucky, dollars an hour, and having to live in an apartment with like three other people and like barely eating just to like make it to the next week. And so like if I'm talking to them, like I'm approaching it from that angle. And if I'm talking to someone who lives in a, who's like more of a suburban, like more, more like privileged lifestyle, then I'm going to talk about like the, number one, I'm going to talk about what we just talked about with climate change and about like the, how it's just not sustainable. And number two, I'm going to talk about the other thing I talked about, which is the fact that like the wealth comes from the global South, like very, very violently and coercively. And so, you know, that could go one of two ways. Like, you know, it
could be, maybe you'll engage or maybe they'll yell at you.
Maybe they'll get really mad. And sometimes they get really mad. And then the other is that when I'm talking to like the poor and oppressed people of this country, of which there are a lot. And I think this is a group of people that like the left really doesn't concern itself with as much as they really should. It feels like a lot of the left is really mainly focused on getting people who kind of have like this middle class, like petite bourgeois lifestyle, kind of like organized and revolutionized. And it, you know, they go to the city and they have like protests and I'm being really vague about which groups these are because I don't want to talk any trash on anybody, but they are out there.
We're always welcome to talk trash about Democrats on my show for sure. Or Republicans.
Always. Every day of my life they're is Democrat. Yeah. And Republicans are a given, of course.
Right. And Libertarians. But anyway, they have protests and
yeah, like,
don't really engage with the people, I guess is where you were going with that.
Yeah, like and in the cities but also in the rural areas, like the poor and oppressed people are just not engaged with. And when they are, it's usually like people coming in and holding signs and yelling stuff at them and stopping traffic and like that. In some places that's a good tactic, but in a lot of other places, like if you don't have a base area, if you don't have organs of political power, or you're not working towards that, if you're not serving the people, if nobody knows who you are except that you come through once in a while holding signs, nobody's going to pay attention to you, even if what you have to say is true. So like that's what the left like tends to do in general. And so that's one of the reasons why For the People exists, is actually kind of like switch up that and actually pay attention.
Excellent. Pay attention. And back to the beginning of the show. You're going to close us out where we started.
Yeah. So, but not just like pay attention or, focus on, but like actually like understand that like the revolution is coming from the poor and oppressed people of the United States. Like it's not coming from suburbia. It's not coming from like white people as a whole. It's coming from the oppressed nations. It's coming from the former colonized people. It's coming from black people. It's coming from people who actually experience oppression on a level where they are forced to actually rupture from it, with a sense of urgency and immediacy, because like that's just the material facts. Like that's just like the fact that like the left has not realized this blows my mind. So, like you say all power to the people, but like which people are you talking about? Are you talking about the people that already have nice things from capitalism, or are you talking about the people who are actually oppressed? Like it's just something that we have to recognize. And like the leadership has to come from the people of like the oppressed nations in this country. And especially from black people. It's because black people are like historically one of the most oppressed people in history.
Right. And yeah, in this like, country, they were brought here as a commodity, not as a person.
Right.
And
everything as actual they had property. To come from, yeah. Yeah.
They were a product for sale. They weren't a person when they were brought here. Everyone else immigrated here.
Right.
People of color, black people didn't immigrate here.
It right. Was and even today.
A violent kidnapping.
Yeah. Like not like, and actually, there's a book called, The New Jim Crow, and it's by a woman named Michelle Alexander. And she actually talks about how like the current period of, she calls the war on drugs and the period of mass incarceration as essentially a continuation of Jim Crow, which itself was an attempt to like continue the legacy of slavery. So there's really like this long history of struggle between
the movie 13 also dealt with a subject that was really good.
That was a good movie.
The 13th Amendment. Yeah, yeah. You know, you're not allowed to, slavery is not allowed unless, of course, you're mass incarcerated in a prison.
Right.
And then
yeah.
you can still be slave labor.
Yeah, exactly. So, and so that's actually why we recognize that like that black people in America actually constitute a geographically dispersed nation, and the word that some use is called like the new African nation, and basically it's just recognizing that the fact that like black people in this country are like oppressed as a group, and it has so much more to do than just like the traditional class analysis that we've always had, and recognizing that like the real revolutionary struggle has always been between black people and Native American people in this country as well, but specifically with black people in this country against the powers of imperialism, against colonialism, against the slave owning class. So like the leadership has to come from black people, and in cities where there are like a majority of black people, like you can't have white people going in there and like calling all the shots, because really that's, you're just continuing what already exists. So like, that's why you need, if you want to serve them and you want to like, you want to get these communities like into revolutionary action, like the first priority is to actually give them power and leadership over whatever resources you're giving them. And that is something that has not happened, in the left. And that's what For the People was founded on, that concept in St. Louis. So that's really important.
How many For the People chapters are there nationally? Do you know?
5. Yeah.
Wow, in New Jersey, Atlantic City has one of them, so that's pretty cool.
Yeah. Yeah. And
are you optimistic? That's where we're going to close it out today. Are you optimistic? How do you keep yourself motivated?
I'm not motivated to act out of a sense of optimism. I'm motivated to act in the sense of urgency, because I recognize like really the base injustice of the whole system, number one, but I also recognize like what this kind of system will end up becoming, like, which is so much worse than it already is now, and what kind of like destruction that will eventually lead to. So I'm motivated to act because like something has to be done, and that something is the revolutionary transformation and destruction of U.S. imperialism and the whole world imperialist system itself, and the construction of socialism, which will eventually lead to communism.
And anyway, it's been good having you here, as always, comrade. Yes, and you're always welcome back anytime. To my listeners, thanks for listening through this. Let us know what you think, if you like the random conversations happening, or if you like a more structured thing, or you want some of both. You know, let us know, because we're here to serve you guys. And to that aim, we do have to ask you if you possibly can help us. We take no corporate money. We're entirely for the activist community, and we're funded by the activist community. So if you can click on that contribute button, we appreciate it, even if it's a couple of dollars a month. That really helps us to budget things and know who we can get reporters out to, what organizations, what kinds of activities can we cover. You know, if it's only myself and Brian running around trying to cover everything in the state, we're going to burn ourselves out, and we need to be able to hire talent and get them to cover organizations and pay them a living wage. So any bit you can contribute, we really appreciate it. Thank you so much. The future's yours to create. Go out there and create it.